before Mr. Obama visited Joplin, he was in France for the G8 summit. And one of the people he spoke with in France was Facebook's founder, Mark Zuckerberg. It's not the first time they've met. In fact, Mr. Obama and other politicians have many reasons to friend Facebook. It can connect them with voters and it can help them raise money. And Facebook announced this week that it's ramping up its presence in Washington, D.C. with a slate of new hires. Here's NPR's White House correspondent Ari Shapiro.
President Obama has done pretty well on Facebook. He recently told an audience at a San Francisco fundraiser that he has 19 million friends.
Which only puts me 500,000 friends behind SpongeBob SquarePants.
He's also friendly with Facebook executives. During a town hall meeting at the company's Palo Alto headquarters, Mr. Obama introduced himself as the man who got company founder Mark Zuckerberg to give up the hooded sweatshirt.
The first time we had dinner together, and he wore this jacket and tie, I'd say halfway through dinner, you know, he's starting to sweat a little bit. It's really uncomfortable for him. So I helped him out of his jacket.
All this coziness makes some privacy activists uncomfortable. Jeff Chester runs the Center for Digital Democracy.
The Obama administration holds the keys to Facebook's future. I mean, I think the president should have been much more cautious when he stood up there with Mark Zuckerberg.
Facebook has more than 600 million members. About half of them visit the website more than once a day to share photographs, describe their feelings, or like a band. All that activity means Facebook owns a huge amount of information about a huge number of people. And the rules for what the company can do with that information are still being written.
So many members of Congress who are going to be weighing into this issue are users of Facebook.
Ray Ramsey is CEO of TechNet, a political and policy network of tech companies that includes Facebook. He believes politicians writing new internet privacy rules can be impartial, even though those same politicians depend on Facebook for fundraising and communications. After all, Ramsey says, the government regulates all kinds of industries that politicians use every day.
We use electricity, but we have an agency that oversees that.
This concept of Facebook as a utility that people cannot live without in the modern world, like electricity, water, or gas, is also gaining traction among Facebook's critics. Christine Rosen of the American Enterprise Institute is editor of a technology journal called The New Atlantis.
If you don't like your power company or your water company, in the United States, you likely have very few alternatives. The same is true, I think, with social networking in this country and, quite frankly, globally. Facebook dominates. So I think people are using it as if they're turning on a light switch or turning on their water. So it might be helpful to start thinking about some of the questions that raises in terms of how the government should look at it.
Facebook, which declined to comment for this story, does not like people to call it a utility. After all, anyone can create a competing social network, and more to the point, utilities are heavily regulated. Already the government is moving towards stronger privacy regulations online. The Obama administration released a policy framework last year, and a bill in the Senate looks similar to the administration's proposal. Ohio State Law Professor Peter Swire was President Clinton's privacy advisor, and he was the lawyer to the Obama social media team during the presidential transition 2 years ago.
When it comes to privacy, the administration has a split within its personality. The campaign was based on motivating people through social networks. On the other hand, the administration is supporting unprecedented privacy protections. Working that out is tough for society, and it's a split within the administration as well.
One administration official who works on these issues remarked that Facebook has disproportionately little contact with the White House compared to other big tech companies. But Facebook is trying to change that. The hires they announced are the first step to catching up with companies like Google and Microsoft in Washington. Ed Black is CEO of the Computer and Communications Industry Association. He argues that these growing ties between politicians and Facebook will have no impact whatsoever on the ultimate set of privacy rules.
Can you really imagine Facebook's going to shut off one-third of the Congress who voted against them on something and not give them access? You realize how absolutely absurd that would be?
While politicians do have an interest in using Facebook, they also have an interest in privacy. Elected officials are at least as worried as the rest of the world about what personal details of their lives online could someday be revealed. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
For the last couple of years, the website Kickstarter has been helping artists, musicians, and filmmakers fund projects by getting lots of people to make small donations. It's enabled people to raise cash for projects that may never have been funded in the past. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
The Kickstarter formula is pretty simple and powerful. It starts with an idea, a project.
This summer, we have a vision for something bigger, better, and more unbelievable.
X-Files, the musical.
The Colonel Mustard Amateur Attic Theater Company in Lincoln, Nebraska, is planning to transform X-Files, the TV show, into X-Files, the musical. They're up on Kickstarter right now, and like most projects on the site, their pitch for funding comes in the form of a video.
We'll need props.
We'll need lumber for the set.
We'll need aliens.
Be a part of something phenomenal.
Help us make this dream a reality.
There's a goal. For X-Files, it was $1,500. There's a deadline, usually 30 to 60 days out. Then friends, family, and often total strangers back the project with a few bucks, sometimes even thousands. If a project meets its goal, it gets funded. Otherwise, the backers aren't charged. It's an all-or-nothing situation. And it works.
Over 600,000 people have pledged to a project on Kickstarter to the tune of over $50 million in our first 2 years. Right now, it's over $2 million a week that's being pledged to projects.
Yancey Strickler is one of the company's founders. The company takes a 5% cut from each successfully funded project. But unlike grants or loans or record deals, when these projects get funded, there are no strings attached.
We don't turn down someone because their art is bad. We've never told someone to rewrite the third act or to ditch the singer or to lose 10 pounds. It's just, are you coming to this with the spirit of wanting to take your idea and express it to the world and see what happens? And are you going to reward the backers who support you in a fair way?
Our bed is green.
This song is from Andrew Rose Gregory's lost album. Well, it's not really lost, but it's been sitting on a shelf for the last year and a half or so.
It's a really sort of niche-ish project in that it's a modern folk rock setting of the Song of Songs, the book of love poetry from the Hebrew Bible.
Gregory is best known as a member of the Gregory Brothers, the crew behind the popular Auto-Tune the News YouTube videos. But he's been a musician for years, and he sees Kickstarter as a way to finally put out this album he really cares about.
I was trying to shop it to record labels, but I've just gotten impatient. And now that Kickstarter has really blown up in the last 2 years, I just think it's a great avenue for me to do it myself in a better way than I've done my albums before.
But artists and musicians aren't the only ones who see opportunity in Kickstarter. Dave Petrillo and David Jackson invented something called coffee jewelies. They're made of stainless steel, formed to look like oversized coffee beans, and they're filled with a special material that they say keeps coffee at the perfect temperature for drinking.
Thanks for watching our video. I'm Dave, and these are jewelies. My friend Dave and I have been working on coffee jewelies for the past 9 months. It started with a problem that I think everyone has experienced. Coffee isn't always the right temperature.
Petrillo and Jackson needed to raise $10,000 to turn their prototype into a real product. But after their video went viral, Petrillo says they raised more than $300,000.
This thing took off really fast, way faster than we thought it was going to.
Coffee Jewelies is now up and running at Cheryl Manufacturing, a silverware factory in upstate New York that was nearly shuttered until the two Daves showed up.
How's it going, Toby?
Going good.
It's going good?
Yeah.
Here's the other Dave, David Jackson.
If we were on a Kickstarter, we'd have to basically build some ourselves, sell them to raise some more money, build some more, and it would have taken at least a year of doing that to get anywhere close to where we are now. And we just completely, you know, leapfrog that within a month.
These more entrepreneurial projects built around a product have taken Kickstarter by storm in recent months. Kickstarter's Yancey Strickler says the company didn't know what to make of it at first.
I think our hearts are very much with the small idiosyncratic arts projects of, you know, some girl in Milwaukee doing something interesting for $500 or the really imaginative documentary. You know, that's sort of our world. But I think that these products have brought an interesting element to Kickstarter that has really helped everybody. And so, you know, I think it's something that we get more comfortable with every day.
What all the projects on Kickstarter have in common is they tell a story about the creators and their desire to make something, be it a neat gadget or an album or a musical based on a TV show about aliens. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
And you can view some of the videos used to sell projects on Kickstarter. Just go to our website, npr.org.
LinkedIn became the first social networking company to sell shares to the public last week. The offering was wildly successful. Shares more than doubled in price the first day. The company, which had $15 million in profits last year, is now worth about $9 billion. Those kind of numbers have some wondering whether we're looking at the start of another tech bubble. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
The last time CNBC sounded this upbeat was over a decade ago.
LinkedIn IPO blowing the lid off the New York Stock Exchange this morning.
Back in early 2000, the Nasdaq was nearly twice where it is now. Investors poured big bucks into anything with a .com. Remember the sock puppet?
I'm a professional happy puppet thing, and it's my job to make animals happy. Pets.com, because pets can't drive.
Pets.com, like many others, failed to generate a profit. Investors pulled out in a huge rush, and it all came crashing down in early 2000. Investors retrenched. They started caring about profits again. Lee Simmons is an industry analyst at Hoover's, a company that tracks IPOs.
We have a lot of echoes of 1999.
This time, the enthusiasm is over social networking. Speculation is that Facebook, Groupon, and Twitter are mulling their own offerings. Simmons says there are plenty of risks for investors, most notably that users are fickle and could ditch these services as quickly as they signed up for them. But that may not be enough to scare investors. He says some people love bubbles.
Bubbles are fun. You know, they're round. They don't hurt initially when you run into them. They get bigger and bigger.
Simmons says venture capitalists, or VCs, are among those willing to fan the hot air.
This is really the first spark of hope that we've seen in the VC industry in a long, long time. And I guarantee you that there is not a single VC backer in this country who isn't thinking about how they're going to go to market as quickly as possible. These guys want to start making money again.
Michael Aronson is a venture capitalist who is, indeed, excited about making money again.
What was the biggest lesson you think you learned about bubbles from the 2000 bubble crash?
Sell when you get the opportunity.
That's it.
Because markets may turn against you.
Aronson got his chance to sell late last year. Diapers.com, which his firm funded, sold to Amazon for a little over $500 million. He was pleased with that deal until LinkedIn showing last week.
Diapers.com was on a path toward IPO, and right now I wish they had stayed on that path because the valuation probably would have been significantly higher.
Aronson, who taught at Wharton School of Business during the last tech boom, says there are significant differences between then and now. Now, companies can do a lot more without having millions of dollars in capital. Web access, computers, servers, and other basic infrastructure is so much cheaper. Also, startups aren't throwing money at Super Bowl ads like they used to. And like LinkedIn, companies these days have been around a few years, long enough to have a proven track record and some profits.
The companies are going public now are the companies that are fairly large companies with, you know, real users, real customers, real revenues, multiple revenue sources.
Anyway, Aronson says it's wrong to think that just because some of those businesses didn't work out in the 1990s that they won't work now. Back then, we relied on clunky dial-up connections. Phones didn't come with high-speed data plans, so online shopping wasn't what it is now. It's funny, Aronson says. Just the other day, he reviewed a couple of business plans proposing to sell, of all things, pet food online. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Now, a new approach to combating online junk mail, better known as spam. Follow the money. You may recall the words of Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates. 2 years from now, spam will be solved. He said that in 2004. And today, the typical online mailbox is still packed with it. It's estimated that 90% of email traffic is spam, and there doesn't seem to be any technical solution out there that's up to the job of controlling it. So, some University of California computer scientists and pioneers of the new field of spamalytics have taken a different approach, receiving spam, buying things that are being sold via spam, studying the system of spam, and looking for the most vulnerable potential choke points. And the news is, they seem to have found some. Stefan Savage is a professor of computer science and engineering at the University of California, San Diego. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And first, tell us about the scope of your work here. How much spam did you and your colleagues actually consume?
We looked at about a billion unique spam messages over the course of 3 months. And then followed all of the links contained therein and visited the websites that were advertising products.
And actually bought stuff.
That's right.
And then when you analyzed all of these transactions, what did you find?
Well, we looked at all of the individual pieces of what we call the value chain. That is everything from the domain name and the links all the way through the sites hosting the goods being advertised, the web page, through payment processing and fulfillment. And what we found is that at most stages of this pipeline, it's very hard to do anything effective because there are so many alternatives and it's so easy to switch. The single biggest exception, however, is in the case of payment processing and merchant bank services.
Banking. You found that a very small number of banks account for a very large share of the spam business.
That's absolutely right. 95% run through just a handful of banks.
A handful, meaning?
Three. One in Azerbaijan, one in St. Kitts and Nevis, and another, previously they were using one in Latvia, and now it appears to be in Russia.
And is there obvious recourse to these banks or these countries to get them to stop doing it?
The sale of these goods is illegal in the United States. These are typically counterfeit pharmaceuticals or luxury products such as Rolex watches. It is not necessarily illegal in jurisdictions in which these banks operate. And so trying to go after these banks individually will both be slow and may be met with some skepticism on their part. The alternative is to look at this from a domestic standpoint, because ultimately the money that funds this activity is U.S. money. And the banks that issue credit cards, Chase, Bank of America, and so forth, were simply to refuse to honor transactions with those particular foreign banks for these particular class of services, it would demonetize the entire activity.
And which was your view here, that it just happens that there are three banks eager to do this trade, or that if you blocked transactions of this sort being paid by American banks for spam to those three banks, that three more banks in three different countries would step in and do the work?
There are far more than three more banks that would be happy to step in and do the work. And this is the challenge of going after the banks themselves, that shame is a very slow process. However, on the issuing side, they can respond very quickly. I can discover if a new bank is being used within a minute by placing a transaction and seeing what bank is used. Whereas for the bad guys, finding a new bank and getting them signed up through Visa and so forth can take, you know, 4, 5, 6 days. So it's one of those rare cases where the defender actually has a huge time advantage if they choose to take this approach.
Professor Savage, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's Stefan Savage, professor of computer science and engineering at the University of California, San Diego.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. We begin today with a visit to a cemetery, a space normally reserved for old marble and perfectly clipped grass. But imagine a headstone with a code that lets you pull up photos and read stories about the dearly departed. We're going to hear about a company that is adding that digital element to the cemetery experience. From member station KPLU in Seattle, Bellamy Palethorpe explains all it takes is a smartphone and a free app.
Death and the human desire for remembrance are the constants that have kept Dave Quiring's company, Quiring Monuments, going for three generations now. He's part grief counselor, part artisan, part editor.
My job is to help people tell a story in stone, generally.
He inherited his role 43 years ago when his dad died. Since then, he's added bronze, glass, even stainless steel and color photographs to the materials this Seattle company uses to make modern headstones. And now he's going digital by offering black and white QR codes for gravestones. You may have seen QR codes in magazine ads. They're a little larger than a postage stamp and look a bit like a combination of a barcode and a Rorschach blot. You scan them with a free smartphone app and they bring up a website. Quiring pulls one from his shirt pocket.
That was my iPhone beeping. And we're slowly chugging information into my phone.
Yeah, you can see it.
A few seconds later, my smartphone brings up a sepia picture of a man in a double-breasted suit looking out at us.
There's my dad.
quite the dapper guy back in 1930.
The monument seller beams at the sight of this picture and the slideshow that follows. There's the obit that was in the newspaper after his dad died, and a scan of part of a Robert Frost poem that his wife found in his wallet. It became Dave Sr.'s epitaph. We head to the Veterans Cemetery that's less than a mile up the road from the shop so we can take a look at his family's plot. From the car, Quiring, who himself served during Vietnam, looks past some blooming cherry trees. Rows and rows of uniform white markers cover the hillside. His shop has a federal contract to make them. He'd love to see his black and white QR code stickers added to each and every one.
And then you could make a tour through there, and it would be more than just a bunch of white monuments. It would be distinct lives of people who really deserve to have their story told.
It's an idea that's catching on, and not just with QR codes. A company in Phoenix has started selling tombstones with RFID tags for digital storytelling. That's a technology used for tracking things like library books and clothing in retail sales.
Oh, yeah.
Also in this cemetery is 80-year-old Harry Coles. He's an Army veteran visiting both his brother's and his mother's graves. He doesn't own a cell phone, much less a smart one. But he likes my demonstration of how the QR codes work at the Quiring family's graves.
There's a bit of a steady hand, but it's not as hard as typing.
I'll be darned. Now that's something new.
Cole says he's old-fashioned, so he wouldn't want anyone to buy one for him. But he thinks having one could mean a lot.
For some people, it brings back happy memories and probably some bad memories. Sorrowful memories, but mostly I would think it's out of love. That's the basis for the whole thing.
And it's the vision for Quiring Monuments, using technology to help future generations connect with their past. For NPR News, I'm Bellamy Palethorpe in Seattle.
To inspire the next generation of scientists, a group of small manufacturers is encouraging kids to make robots. And not just any kind of robots, these are robot gladiators. NPR's Chris Arnold has the story.
For a lot of kids in high school, robots are pretty cool. And of course, gladiators are pretty cool too. So what could possibly be cooler than robot gladiators?
Okay, let's get ready for fight number two.
And three, two, one, let it rip.
It's a Saturday morning, and 100 high school students from around the country have met in an airplane hangar in Indianapolis for a robot battle. These competitions are held from time to time in different cities. Each school team brings robots that they've built. They don't look like mechanical people, more like remote control cars, but with spinning metal blades and other weapons attached to them. They weigh about 15 pounds. The robots fight inside an 8-foot-high bulletproof glass cage. The students drive using controls from outside. Local business owner Steve Overton is announcing the match.
Down. Oh, that was a big hit.
The bulletproof glass is actually a good idea, since these little robots really tear each other up and send chunks of metal flying in all directions. One robot, named Armageddon, smashes its opponent, it's named Steel Raptor, with a spinning hammer-type weapon, and it goes flying 6 feet in the air.
Steel Raptor is completely banged up.
Whoa. Steel Raptor is finally looking completely dead, and the match is over.
Once you got him,
yeah, baby, yes.
Yeah.
Hey, you guys, so you did some damage in that one there, it looked like. Huh?
A little more than I expected.
Our team name, Slinger Bots Club, from Slinger, Wisconsin.
Now, plenty of Americans have unusual hobbies, but there's a greater goal in the background here. The organizers are trying to get young people interested in high-tech manufacturing.
Manufacturing's not a smokestack industry anymore. What we do is cool.
Grady Cope is the chairman of the National Tooling and Machining Association, which sponsors this robot fight league. He owns his own manufacturing company outside of Denver.
We don't have any incoming young people into our businesses, and our businesses are all ready to grow right now. And one of the things we really wanted to do was find a way to attract kids back to the engineering and manufacturing environment.
To get help building the robots, high school and some college students match up with local manufacturers. And so they get to see inside of a modern manufacturing shop. Many have big computer-controlled robotic machines that make parts for all kinds of stuff. Jet engines, racing bicycles, medical tools for surgery. And these businesses need workers who are good with their hands and who are also good with math and can program and operate these kind of machines.
I'm Anna. I'm from Lincoln Sudbury, and I'm 15.
Anna Zolnikoff is the driver of one of her team's robots, and she probably had the most dramatic hit of the day, knocking out an opponent in about 3 seconds. Right now, she's working on another robot in the pit crew area.
I'm fixing my robot, which was one of its teeth was knocked off in a fight, so I'm putting them all back together.
And overall, the effort here seems to be working. At the next table over, Dakota Cleaver is a high school senior from Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. He says he's going to be going to college next year to study high-tech engineering.
When I came into high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do, but getting to do this definitely got me interested in the engineering aspect of things.
But first, he has to get his robot, named Excessive Force, ready for its next battle. It has a big steel and bronze lobster-like claw hanging off of one side of it. Chris Arnold, NPR News.